The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the March 21st, 2014 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Putin's annexation of Crimea. What happened? A defiant Russian President Vladimir Putin cemented his grip on the Crimean Peninsula this week, as Crimean voters were on the verge of approving a referendum to secede from Ukraine and become part of Russia. Putin spurned Western nations' protest on the eve of the March 16th referendum, which was to take place with at least 18,000 Russian troops stationed in Crimea and Ukrainian military bases surrounded by pro-Russian forces. Russia's parliament said it would allow Crimea, which has a majority Russian population, to become a Russian region. Secretary of State John Kerry said the annexation would violate international law and warned that the Obama administration was prepared to punish Russia with visa bans and banking and business sanctions. "I don't want to go into all of the detail," he said, "except to say this. It can get ugly fast if the wrong choices are made." As President Obama pledged support and financial aid to Ukrainian interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk in a White House meeting, the U.S. business community was lobbying the administration not to impose tough sanctions on Russia, over fears that many American companies with interest there would be hurt. Germany, which relies on Russia for a third of its natural gas, and other European nations were also hesitant to hit Moscow with sanctions. European Union leaders did agree to slap travel restrictions and asset freezes on Russian officials if Crimea is annexed. What the editorial said: Crimea's plebiscite, announced 10 days after Russia's invasion, is by definition a joke, said Bloomberg.com. Yet the implications here are serious. No major country has annexed territory since World War II. The annexation will be dangerously destabilizing. Ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine and other former Soviet republics may also start agitating to rejoin the motherland, risking the possibility of violent ethnic clashes throughout the region. Putin must pay a steep price for his aggression, said the New York Times. If he annexes Crimea, the U.S. and Europe should bar Moscow's banks from international markets, cutting Russian corporations off from sorely needed foreign borrowing. The Western assets of Russia's billionaire oligarchs should be seized. If the U.S. and Europe cannot accept the economic sacrifices needed to punish Putin, the West will have no leverage. What the columnist said: sanctions might work if Putin were in touch with reality, said Louise Branson in USA Today. But he's been surrounded by sycophants and propaganda organs during his 14 years in power, and Putin's perception of reality is extremely distorted. The dictator who poses bare-chested on a horse truly seems to believe he's a Superman destined to restore the Russian Empire, and that he can seize what he wants to, and nobody can or will stop him. Sanctions won't deter Putin, because the only thing a bully understands is force, said Jim Thomas in the Wall Street Journal. NATO allies should permanently station troops in Poland, Romania, and other frontline Eastern Europe states, and back them up with missile defense systems. That would firmly warn Russia not to encroach on their sovereignty in the name of protecting ethnic Russian populations. Crimea may never again be part of Ukraine, said Chrystia Freeland in the New York Times. But no matter what happens in coming weeks and months, Putin and his authoritarian vision for the region have already lost. Even the Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine are proud Ukrainians, and Putin's invasion of Crimea is succeeding only in uniting the country's different factions in favor of democratic rule, rather than subjugation by Moscow. Putin's long-term prospects are bleak, said Eric Posner in Slate.com. By grabbing Crimea, a poor, tiny region, he has lost the bigger fight over Ukraine, which will tilt further toward Europe. He has spooked foreign investors needed to energize Russia's moribund economy. Soviet satellites like Armenia and Tajikistan will refuse to join his Eurasian Union out of fear the project will lead to Russian domination. Far from restoring Russia to greatness, Putin has guaranteed its future as a declining state that can do little more than bully a few impoverished and geopolitically insignificant neighbors. And the second main story, the airplane that vanished. The mystery deepened this week surrounding Malaysia Airlines flight that disappeared without a distress call last week, 1 hour after taking off from Kuala Lumpur. Flight 370 last made radar contact with air traffic controllers from 35,000 feet over the Gulf of Thailand. As the week went to press, a Chinese defense agency said that Chinese satellite images taken a day later might show three large pieces of floating debris near its last known location, which could allow investigators to narrow the 27,000 square nautical mile search area. But no wreckage had been found 4 days after the plane vanished, intensifying the grief for families of the 239 people aboard. Malaysian authorities said they were considering many possible theories, including mechanical failure, pilot error, terrorism, and pilot suicide. Questions arose about whether the Boeing 777 had been inspected for fuselage cracks, a model-specific problem that the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration warned last year could lead to rapid decompression and loss of structural integrity. The sudden disappearance of an aircraft is not unprecedented, said Jordan Golson in Wired.com. Commercial airliners are not in constant contact with air traffic control, and radio communications generally occur only at fixed reporting points. Pilots are trained to aviate first and communicate last, so a catastrophic event may have precluded a distress call. And while the cause remains unknown, most experts believe the incident occurred at high altitude, scattering debris over a vast area. Wreckage from the 2009 Atlantic Ocean crash of Air France Flight 447 wasn't found for 5 days, and the plane's black box data recorder wasn't recovered for 2 years. So why isn't black box data transmitted in real time? Asked the New York Times in an editorial. The typically bright orange devices store vital data such as telemetry and cockpit communications. The technology exists for that data to be streamed as it is collected, rather than stored in a physical object that stays on board. To date, the rarity of in-flight disasters and the cost of new equipment have kept most carriers from upgrading. But there is a cost of doing nothing, such as trying to find a tiny box in a vast ocean. In our controversy of the week, the CIA, at war with its congressional watchdogs. This isn't just a scandal, said David Korn in MotherJones.com. This is a full-blown constitutional crisis. In a fiery speech on the Senate floor, Senate Intelligence Committee Chairwoman Dianne Feinstein this week accused the Central Intelligence Agency of spying on and trying to sabotage Senate staffers investigating the CIA's use of torture under the Bush administration. The CIA lied to her committee's investigators and illegally hacked into their computers, an indignant Feinstein said, and thereby violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution. She called the open war between the CIA and its congressional overseers a defining moment. It sure is, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. The CIA is trying to conceal from Congress and the American public its own damning internal report on its torture practices, which it mistakenly made available to Feinstein's investigators, tried to snatch back from their computers, and then accused them of stealing. If the CIA gets away with this outrage, the system that keeps the intelligence community's vast power in check has broken down. Welcome aboard, Senator Feinstein, said Peggy Noonan in WSJ.com. In the years since 9/11, many of us have watched the insidious growth of the U.S. surveillance state with deepening discomfort. Yet Feinstein, despite her generally liberal Democratic record, always seemed to dismiss our concerns as the yips and yaps of kids who aren't aware of the brute realities she hears about in classified briefings. The CIA's charter expressly forbids it from doing any domestic spying, said Ed Morrissey in HotAir.com, let alone spying on congressional committees overseeing its conduct. This is among the worst possible accusations that could be leveled against the intelligence service in a constitutional republic. There is no longer any doubt about it, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. The CIA has become a rogue agency. The agency has already admitted destroying videotapes of interrogation sessions, utilizing waterboarding, physical abuse, and other techniques that were clearly war crimes under international law. When Feinstein's committee obtained a previously secret internal CIA report showing the true horrific nature of the torture, CIA Director John Brennan and his underlings obviously freaked out and tried to sabotage the investigation by raiding its computers. This is a perfect example of how the use of torture corrodes a democracy, said Gary Young in TheGuardian.com. When a state has deliberately created space for power to be exercised without accountability in the name of a higher good, that is, defeating terrorism, it's only a matter of time before the monster turns on the state itself. Obama deserves as much blame as George W. Bush, said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com. Obama's nakedly political decision not to investigate or prosecute war crimes under the previous administration left the CIA with an alarming number of staffers who, a few short years ago, were complicit in torturing humans. Indeed, many of those officials have risen to leadership positions. Robert Ettinger, the CIA lawyer who authorized the destruction of the torture videotapes, is now fighting Feinstein as the lawyer for the entire CIA. The agency is engaged in a clear-cut cover-up, said the New York Times in an editorial, and it's the president's responsibility to end it. He must authorize the full release of both the Senate and CIA reports on the use of torture. Obama should realize that when he has lost Dianne Feinstein, he has no choice but to act in favor of disclosure and accountability. And it was a good week for delivery drones after a federal judge ruled that the FAA did not have the authority to stop a Detroit florist from delivering flowers by drone. Drones have arrived, said the florist CEO, adding that test deliveries will resume. It was a good week for Canadian exhibitionists after a broadcast regulator reprimanded three Toronto-based erotica channels for not serving up the required 35% of Canadian content. The government wants to hear a few more A's along the way with the oohs and ahs, said globalnews.ca. It was a good week for torture after a Washington State high school kept playing Justin Bieber's Baby on the intercom until students donated $500 to charity. My head is about to explode, said one student. It was a bad week for irritating the cat after Portland, Oregon police had to be called in to subdue an ornery 22-pound house cat that had attacked its owners and trapped them inside their bedroom. It's only funny when it's not happening to you, said owner Teresa Barker. It was a bad week for being cheap. After a Lawton, Oklahoma man who climbed into a storm drain to retrieve a dropped $20 bill wound up trapped underground for 2 days. The man was rescued when children heard screams for help coming from a manhole cover. It was a bad week for chemical warfare after a competitor at the North American Grappling Association's championship suddenly surrendered the match, telling his opponent, "You farted in my face, man." He then vomited on the mat. Well, I didn't see that one coming, folks. I might have skipped on that one had I read ahead. Why don't we turn on over to the briefing page? The tragic price of ivory. Poachers are killing thousands of African elephants for their tusks. Can the ivory trade be stopped? How extensive is the poaching? Poachers are now slaughtering up to 35,000 of the estimated 500,000 African elephants every year for their tusks. A single male elephant's two tusks can weigh more than 250 pounds, with a pound of ivory fetching as much as $1,500 on the black market. The ivory is so valuable because all across Asia, particularly in China, ivory figurines are given as traditional gifts, and ivory chopsticks, hair ornaments, and jewelry are highly prized luxuries. China regards ivory as a cultural heritage. They are not going to ban it, said Grace Gabriel in the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Many Chinese consumers don't realize that elephants must be killed for their ivory. In one survey, more than two-thirds of Chinese respondents said they thought tusks grew back like fingernails. What impact has the slaughter had on the elephants? Elephants are highly intelligent social creatures that live in matriarchal groups, and poaching has ravaged much of their social structure. The biggest tusks are found on the largest breeding males and on the oldest females, who lead the elephant troops. Where these animals are targeted and killed, elephant populations are reduced to leaderless groups of traumatized orphans huddling together. In the past year, even they are being wiped out, as some poachers have started dumping cyanide into watering holes, killing every animal that drinks there. Last year, poachers killed an estimated 300 elephants in Zimbabwe's largest park, Hwange, by lacing watering holes and salt licks with cyanide. Who are the poachers? Since the industry is illegal, those who run it largely come from criminal syndicates or terrorist organizations. Al-Shabaab, the Somalia-based wing of Al-Qaeda, raises $600,000 a month from poaching to fund its activities. Uganda's Lord's Resistance Army, the rebel group notorious for enslaving children, also raises money through poaching. Poaching has become one of the most profitable criminal activities there is, says Peter Seligman, the CEO of Conservation International. Chinese mafia organizations mostly do the purchasing and distribution of ivory after it's been obtained, selling it mostly in China and Southeast Asia, but sometimes to markets in the U.S. Why is the price so high? When ivory became contraband, the supply got scarcer, but demand remained strong. In 1989, the international community passed a global ban on the trade in new ivory to stop the killing of elephants. Only ivory that had been harvested before 1989 could be sold. So the ivory carving industry in China crumbled, and with it the demand for tusks. Elephant populations rebounded, so much so that in 1999, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, CITES, a global organization, decided to allow a one-off sale of pre-ban stockpiled ivory to Japan. Then in 2008, it authorized another one-off sale, this time to Japanese and Chinese markets. The Chinese carving industry roared back to life as the Chinese government licensed dozens of carving factories and retail outlets. Since there's no way to distinguish between pre-ban and new ivory, the illegal ivory trade has accelerated to meet demand, and poaching is now worse than before the global ban. What steps are being taken to stop poaching? Under pressure from some member nations, CITES refuses to institute a complete ban on the ivory trade. But the U.S. is taking its own measures. The U.S. is the second biggest ivory market after China. In a symbolic gesture last fall, U.S. officials smashed 6 tons of contraband ivory, including tusks and carvings that had been seized from smugglers or confiscated from unwitting tourists. And in February, the Obama administration announced it would change regulations to ban interstate sales of all ivory except certified antiques, limit elephant trophy imports to 2 per hunter, and end commercial imports of antique ivory. Is China cooperating? Following the U.S.'s ivory crush, the Chinese government destroyed 6 tons this January, and Hong Kong authorities say they will destroy their 30-ton stockpile, one of the largest in the world. Chinese environmentalists have also begun educating the public about the dire consequences of buying ivory. But it's a tough sell in a country where ivory has long symbolized wisdom and nobility. With more disposable income in mainland China, many people are flaunting their wealth, and ivory is seen as a luxury product that confers status, says Tom Milliken of the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network. Why is the ban so hard to enforce? There is no reliable way to tell pre-ban from post-ban ivory, or a real antique from a fake, in any country. It's not like you walk into a store and find someone selling cocaine, which is illegal on its face, said Edward Grace, Deputy Assistant Director for Law Enforcement at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In Chinese and U.S. shops alike, consumers simply assume that ivory trinkets are legal, and there is no way for law enforcement to prove that any particular item was made after 1989. Mary Rice, Executive Director of the Environmental Investigation Agency, says there's only one real solution. We need to learn from history and permanently shut down all ivory trade, international and domestic. Endangered Asian elephants. Asian elephants are even more endangered than African elephants, but the threat isn't poaching so much as human encroachment. The Asian species is smaller than the African, and none of the females and only some of the males have tusks. While some are hunted for ivory or meat, most of the Asian elephants taken from the wild are not killed, but domesticated for zoos, safari tourism, or timber hauling. There are only about 30,000 remaining wild Asian elephants, while 15,000 live in captivity. The wild herds in India, Sri Lanka, and Thailand are dwindling too, as human development shrinks their habitat. Many populations are now cut off from migration routes and forced to inbreed. We'll take a look now at the best columns from the U.S. The first one comes to us from Tom Rogan, NationalReview.com. The irrelevance of the United Nations. Once again, the United Nations has been rendered impotent by a small group of thugs, said Tom Rogan. When Russia's Vladimir Putin violated Ukraine's sovereignty by seizing Crimea, the UN, which supposedly exists to maintain some semblance of international order, issued an appeal for calm. There were no condemnations and no sanctions. Robert Seri, a UN representative sent to monitor Crimea, was greeted by Putin's armed henchmen, who ordered him to get out, or else. This is just the latest in a string of humiliations for the organization, which is now nothing more than a big NGO, delivering humanitarian aid to disaster areas like Syria. The UN botched its missions in Bosnia, Kosovo, and East Timor, and simply ignored the genocide in Rwanda. It is no longer a fundamental force for good. In a further demonstration that the UN stands for nothing, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon recently made a big show of welcoming the new ambassador from the psychotic necrocracy of North Korea. Global security? Human rights? Sadly, the UN now exists only to promote empty handshakes, photo opportunities, and polite conversation. From Jonathan Chait at nymag.com, Millennial Trouble for the GOP. Young liberals own the future of American politics, said Jonathan Chait. The millennial generation will make up a sizable 24% of voters by 2016, and a new Pew Research survey shows that they're more liberal than their elders on almost every issue. The findings point to an existential dilemma for Republicans. Millennials are much less white than older voters, meaning that conservatives will have to win even higher margins among whites merely to stay even with Democrats. And millennials are much more liberal than previous generations. And a majority of them say they favor bigger government and universal health coverage, which the GOP at its core opposes. Only 26% of millennials call themselves conservative, compared with 41% of the baby boomers and 45% of the World War II generation. In the short term, the GOP can still win House and Senate races by tapping the anger of older white Americans, but the electorate is growing steadily more liberal. If the GOP doesn't evolve on such issues as health care, immigration, and gay marriage, it will have to forget about winning national elections. And the third column from James Antle III in the AmericanConservative.com, Rand Paul's Libertarian Alternative. If Republicans truly want lower taxes and less intrusive government, they can no longer support a national security state and $1 trillion wars of choice. That was Rand Paul's very well-received message last week to the Conservative Political Action Conference, said W. James Antle III. Among the young activists who dominate CPAC, Paul won the presidential straw poll by 20 points over Senator Ted Cruz and 25 points over Senator Marco Rubio, both of whom also have presidential ambitions in 2016. Paul, a consistent libertarian, sought to differentiate himself from the likely GOP field by arguing that viewing the U.S. as a permanent battlefield in the war on terror is utterly incompatible with constitutionally limited government. You can have drone warfare and constant surveillance of phone calls and internet activity, Paul noted, or you can have the Bill of Rights, but you can't have both. And you will never have a balanced budget and lower taxes if the U.S. is funding frequent military interventions abroad. As the saying goes, to govern is to choose. When the 2016 primaries begin, Paul will be offering the GOP a starkly different choice. And an obituary for you this week. The executive who kept the Fords in Ford, William Clay Ford, 1925 to 2014. Henry Ford taught him to drive. Charles Lindbergh piloted his first airplane ride. Edison's and Rockefeller's were guests at his wedding. Such were the advantages of being born William Clay Ford, the last surviving grandson of automotive icon Henry Ford. And it was thanks to his persistence that the company started by his grandfather in 1903 still remains in family control. Before the company went public in 1956, Ford clashed with his eldest brother, Henry Ford II, then the Ford chairman, and insisted that the family retain a minimum 40% of the voting rights. "I don't care if it flies or not," Ford told company advisors, worried that the precondition would sink the IPO. "That's the way it's going to be." His son, William Clay Ford Jr., is the company's current executive chairman. Ford was named to Ford's board of directors in 1948 at age 23, said the Washington Post, and served as vice chairman from 1980 to 1989. In 1963, he bought the NFL's Detroit Lions, which, despite his free spending and often high expectations, amassed a losing record of 310, 441, and 13, with just one playoff victory in 50 seasons. Praised by players and staff for his uncommon generosity, Ford showed a penchant for being frustratingly loyal to poorly performing coaches and team executives, creating a somewhat uneasy relationship with Lions fans. As a child, Ford liked to sit with his father, Edsel, painting watercolors of luxury cars, said Forbes.com. That passion for design carried over into his career, and he played an integral part in the development and design of the Lincoln Continental Mark II, one of Ford's signature models. "We have a tremendous pride in the Ford name," he told shareholders at the company's 100th anniversary in 2003, "and a great desire to see the Ford name in the forefront of world transportation." And now the last word, our in-depth article, toast, the next big thing. "Artisanal toasts seemed ridiculous," said John Grevois, "until I tracked down the woman who created it. All the guy was doing was slicing inch-thick pieces of bread, putting them in a toaster, and spreading stuff on them. But what made me stare, blinking to attention in the middle of a workday morning as I waited in line at an unfamiliar cafe, was the way he did it. He had the solemn intensity of a ping-pong player who keeps his game very close to the table, knees slightly bent, wrist flicking the butter knife back and forth, eyes suggesting a kind of flow state. The coffee shop, called the Red Door, was a spare little operation in downtown San Francisco. There were just three employees working behind the counter. one making coffee, one taking orders, and the soulful guy making toast. In front of him, laid out in a neat row, were a few long Pullman loaves, the boxy Wonder Bread shape, like a train car, but recognizably handmade and freshly baked. And on the brief menu, toast was a standalone item at $3 per slice. It took me just a few seconds to digest what this meant, that toast, like the cupcake and the dill pickle before it, had been elevated to the artisanal plane. So I ordered some. It was pretty good. It tasted just like toast, but better. A couple of weeks later, I was at a place called Acre Coffee in Petaluma, north of San Francisco. Half of the shop's food menu fell under the heading Toast Bar. Not long after that, I went to The Mill, a big light-filled cafe and bakery in the city. A small chalkboard listed the day's toast menu. Everywhere, the offerings were more or less the same. Thick slices of good bread, square-shaped, topped with things like small-batch almond butter or apricot marmalade or sea salt. Back at the Red Door one day, I asked the manager what was going on. "Why all the toast?" "Tip of the hipster spear," he said. I had two reactions to this. First, of course, I rolled my eyes. How silly, how twee, how perfectly San Francisco this toast. And second, despite myself, I felt a little thrill of discovery. How many weeks would it be, I wondered, before artisanal toast made it to Brooklyn, or Chicago, or Los Angeles? How long before an article appears in Slate telling people all across America that they're making toast all wrong? How long before the backlash sets in? For whatever reason, I felt compelled to go looking for the origins of the fancy toast trend. If the discovery of artisanal toast had made me roll my eyes, it soon made other people in San Francisco downright indignant. I spent the early part of my search following the footsteps of a very low-stakes mob. $4 toast, why the tech industry is ruining San Francisco, ran the headline of an August article on a local technology news site called VentureBeat. For a few weeks, $4 toast became a rallying cry in the city's media, an instant parable and parody of the shallow, expensive new San Francisco. The butt of all this criticism appeared to be The Mill, which also supplies the Red Door with its bread. So I assumed I had found the cradle of the toast phenomenon. I was wrong. When I called Josie Baker, baker behind The Mill's toast, he was a little mystified by the dust-up over his product while also being taken aback at how popular it had become. On a busy Saturday or Sunday, we'll make 350 to 400 pieces of toast, he told me. It's ridiculous, isn't it? But Baker assured me that he was not the Chuck Berry of fancy toast. He was its Elvis. He had merely caught the trend on its upswing. The place I was looking for, he and others told me, was a coffee shop in the city's Outer Sunset neighborhood, a little spot called Trouble. The Trouble Coffee and Coconut Club is a tiny storefront next to a Spanish immersion preschool, about 3 blocks from the Pacific Ocean in one of the city's windiest, foggiest, farthest-flung areas. As places of business go, I would call Trouble impressively odd. Instead of a standard cafe patio, Trouble's outdoor seating area is dominated by a substantial section of a tree trunk, stripped of its bark, lying on its side. The shop itself is about the size of a single-car garage, with an L-shaped bar made of driftwood, and a glass refrigerator case beneath the cash register prominently displays a bunch of coconuts and grapefruit. Next to the cash register is a single steel toaster. Trouble's specialty is a thick slice of locally made white toast, generously covered with butter, cinnamon, and sugar, a variation on the cinnamon toast that everyone's mom, including mine, seemed to make when I was a kid in the 1980s. Trouble's owner and the apparent originator of San Francisco's toast craze is a slight, blue-eyed, 34-year-old woman with freckles tattooed on her cheeks named Julieta Corelli. She has a good toast story. She grew up in Cleveland in a big immigrant family. Her father, a tailor from Italy, her mother, an ex-nun. The family didn't eat much standard American food, but cinnamon toast, made in a pinch, was the exception. "We never had pie," Corelli says. "Our American comfort food was cinnamon toast." The other main players on Trouble's menu are coffee, young Thai coconuts, and shots of fresh squeezed grapefruit juice called Yoko. It's a strange lineup, but each item has specific meaning to Corelli. Toast, she says, represents comfort. Coffee represents speed and communication. And coconuts represent survival. Because it's possible, Corelli says, to survive on coconuts, provided you also have a source of vitamin C. Hence, the Yoko. Corelli tested this theory by living mainly on coconuts and grapefruit juice for 3 years. Unless someone took me out to dinner. The menu also features a go-for-broke option called Build Your Own Damn House, which consists of a coffee, a coconut, and a piece of cinnamon toast. Hanging in the door is a manifesto that covers a green chalkboard. "We are local people with useful skills in tangible situations," it says, among other things. "Drink a cup of trouble, eat a coconut, and learn to build your own damn house." At first, Corelli explained, Trouble as a kind of sociological experiment in engineering spontaneous communication between strangers. She even conducted field research, she says, before opening the shop. "I did a study in New York and San Francisco, standing on the street holding a sandwich, saying hello to people. No one would talk to me. But if I stayed at the same street corner and I was holding a coconut, people would engage," she said. "I wrote down exactly how many people talked to me." And cinnamon toast, she said, is a kind of all-purpose mollifier. No one could be mad at toast, she said. Corelli's explanations made a delightfully weird, fleeting kind of sense as I heard them. But then she told me something that made Trouble snap into focus. More than a cafe, the shop is a carpentered-together, ingenious mechanism, a specialized tool designed to keep Corelli tethered to herself. Ever since she was in high school, Corelli says, she has had something called schizoaffective disorder, a condition that combines symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolarity. People who have it are susceptible to both psychotic episodes and bouts of either mania or depression. One day in 1999, when Corelli was living in San Francisco and going to school at the University of California, Berkeley, she took a long walk through the city and ended up on China Beach, a small cove west of the Golden Gate. A group of Russian men in Speedos were stepping out of the frigid ocean, and an elderly man was sitting on a towel, sunbathing in weather that suggested anything but. Corelli struck up a conversation with the man, whose name was Glenn. He told her that people swam there regularly and that he sunbathed every day. Corelli left San Francisco shortly thereafter, but her encounter with the old man and the swimmer somehow made such a profound impression that 5 years later, she drove back across the country and headed for China Beach. When she arrived, she found Glenn sitting in the same spot where she had left him. That day, as they parted ways, he said, "See you tomorrow." For the next 3 years, he said the same words to her pretty much every day. Having spent much of her adult life careening in and out of periods of homelessness and failing to maintain relationships with roommates and boyfriends, Corelli found a kind of bedrock routine at China Beach. She started joining the swimmers every day, even in winter, and she began cultivating a network of people she could count on for help when she was in trouble, a word she uses frequently to refer to her psychotic episodes, while being careful not to overtax any individual's generosity. Corelli also found safety in simply being well known, in attracting as many acquaintances as possible through coffee shop jobs and random conversations. This gregariousness was in part a survival mechanism, as were her tattoos and her daily uniform of headscarves, torn jeans, and crop tops. The trick was to be identifiable. The more people who recognized her, the more she stood a chance of being able to recognize herself when she was in a dissociated state. As Corelli found her footing in the world, an idea began to take shape. At China Beach, she took to her notebooks, filling them with grandiose manifestos about living with guts and honor and commitment. About, she wrote, building her own damn house. "Julieta, you don't have enough money to eat tonight," Glenn said, bringing her down to earth. Then he asked her a question that has since appeared in her writing again and again. "What is your useful skill in a tangible situation?" The answer was easy. She was good at making coffee and good with people. So Glenn told her it was time she opened a checking account. He told her to go to City Hall and ask if they had information on starting a small business. And she did. After having struggled as an employee in so many coffee shops, she now employs 14 people. In an almost unheard-of practice for the cafe business, she offers them profit sharing and dental coverage. She hopes to one day open a halfway house for people who have psychotic episodes, a safe place where they can go when they are in trouble. If the spread of toast is a social contagion, then Corelli was its perfect vector. Most of us dedicate the bulk of our attention to a handful of relationships, with a significant other, children, parents, a few close friends. Social scientists call these strong ties. But Corelli can't rely on such a small set of intimates. Strong ties have a history of failing her, of buckling under the weight of her illness. So she has adapted by forming as many relationships, as many weak ties, as she possibly can. And the webs of weak ties are what allow ideas to spread. This is by John Gravois, copyright 2014 by Pacific Standard. Take a look now on the health and science page. Resurrecting an ancient virus. French researchers have revived a dormant and previously unknown virus from a 30,000-year-old sample of Siberian permafrost. The pathogen poses no threat to humans, but its zombie-like return to an infectious state demonstrates the remarkable durability of microbes and raises the question of whether unknown disease-causing viruses from some ancient era might be locked in ice. This is a good demonstration that the notion that a virus could be eradicated from the planet is plain wrong and gives us a false sense of security, Jean-Michel Claveri of the Mediterranean Institute of Microbiology tells Smithsonian.com. The virus, Pithovirus sibericum, is between 10 and 100 times larger than an average-size virus and its 500 genes give it far greater genetic complexity than the common influenza virus. All viruses require host cells to reproduce, and they exist in an inert state in between reproductive cycles, much like a plant's seed does. In this instance, researchers thawed a sample of frozen soil taken from 100 feet underneath the surface, then placed it on a petri dish containing amoeba colonies. The resuscitated virus was absorbed by the amoebas and then began making copies of itself until it split open its host, killing them. The health scare of the week. Dangers of too much protein. Consuming a lot of meat, milk, and cheese may be as risky to your health as smoking. A new long-range study has found that adults who ate a diet high in animal proteins during middle age were 4 times more likely to die of cancer during the study period and 3 times more likely to die of diabetes than those who followed low-protein diets. The majorities of Americans are eating about twice as much protein as they should. Walter Longo of the University of Southern California Longevity Institute tells Forbes.com, the researchers tracked more than 6,300 adults over age of 50 for nearly 2 decades. Those subscribing to a high-protein diet were defined as deriving at least 20% of their calories from protein, medium protein 10 to 19%, and low protein less than 10%. The findings suggest that plant-based proteins, such as those from beans, aren't as problematic as animal proteins. Researchers said that people older than 65 may actually benefit from eating more protein, as it can guard against frailty and help them maintain healthy weight. While eating less protein is generally a good idea, said Longo, don't get extreme in cutting out protein. You can go from protected to malnourished very quickly. On the talking points page, sexual assault. Can the military police its own? When it comes to sexual assault, the military keeps finding new ways to appall us, said Petula Dvorak in the Washington Post. Pentagon officials last week admitted that the Army's top sexual assault prosecutor, Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Morse, was being investigated for allegedly groping a female subordinate at, of all places, a conference on sexual assault. On the very same day, the Senate blocked a bill by Democratic Senator Kristen Gillibrand requiring military rape cases to be handled by an independent prosecutor rather than commanders, a proposal strongly opposed by the Pentagon brass. The current system is clearly not working, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. An estimated 26,000 military personnel were sexually assaulted in 2012, and 86% didn't report their attacks out of fear of retaliation or punishment. Why would female soldiers report a rape to a boss who may protect the perpetrator? Or is the perpetrator? Actually, the military has already taken steps to prevent that problem, said Amy Davidson in NewYorker.com. Under new rules, victims no longer have to report assaults to their immediate commander, but can instead go straight to a higher-ranking officer. That makes sense. Taking rape cases out of the chain of command, on the other hand, would likely result in fewer prosecutions. Officers are motivated by a desire for discipline and order in the ranks, but prosecutors will only take cases they can win. That's why the Senate is now strengthening the existing system, said Melinda Hennenberger in the Washington Post. The lawmakers this week passed a rival bill by Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill that requires a civilian board to review cases that senior officers decline to prosecute. Still, it's hard to believe the military can effectively police its own, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. In scores of cases, officers have pressured subordinates to drop rape cases to spare the military from embarrassment. Now, as the Pentagon comes under increasing pressure to take action against sexual assaults, commanders might overreact and proceed with shaky cases that would never stand up in a civilian court. The less soldiers have to do with prosecuting sexual assault, the better it may be for both the victims and the cause of justice. We'll wind down with a few notes. Among Christians, giving up something for the 40 days of Lent, 31% say they're fasting from technology, with 16% foregoing social media such as Facebook and Twitter. That from MarketWatch.com. This from USA Today. Use of public transit in the U.S. rose to its highest levels in more than 50 years last year, as more and more Americans opt for buses, trains, and subways instead of driving. Since 1995, public transit ridership has increased by 37%, outpacing the 20% population growth over the same period. A new study estimates that more than 500,000 Americans a year die of Alzheimer's, six times the number recorded on death certificates. That would make the degenerative disease the third largest cause of death, after heart disease and cancer. And finally, a quote to finish with from A.A. Milne, quoted in the Detroit News. Some people talk to animals. Not many listen, though. And that's the problem. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.